Amid a growing global hunger crisis, Russia halts a grain deal that the UN says could lead to immense suffering.
Hundreds of millions of people face hunger, and consumers are confronting a global cost of living crisis. And they will pay the price.
Plus, extreme heat radiates around the globe.
I'm 22 years old, but never in my life I experienced this kind of heating before.
And beauty salon owners and women's rights activists in Afghanistan are devastated by an order for the businesses to shut down. Today is Tuesday, July 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Lori London in Washington. A deal allowing the safe Black Sea export of Ukraine's grain for the past year expired on Monday after Russia quit and warned it could not guarantee the safe passage of ships. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said the lack of a deal risks the lives of the world's most vulnerable people.
Ultimately, participation in these agreements is a choice, but struggling people everywhere and developing countries don't have a choice.
Guterres said he offered Russia a new proposal for grain exports, but, says Moscow, has chosen instead to deprive poor nations of food supplies. The Black Sea grain deal, brokered by the United Nations and Turkey last July, aimed to hasten the global food crisis by allowing Ukrainian grain, blocked by Russia's invasion, to flow safely from Ukraine to countries in Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias spoke with Bob Kitchen with the International Rescue Committee on his concerns and the consequences of Russia's decision to pull out of the agreement.
It's very serious indeed. There's 349 million people around the world who are living in food insecurity, meaning that they don't have enough food to feed themselves and their families. So this will reduce the amount of food that is available on the market, driving up prices, and it'll make a massive, massive difference to people around the world. What's needed is that the world needs to continue trying to persuade Russia to re-enter the deal, get it up and running again, and if not, then they need to turn their attention to the places most at risk of famine, making sure that the plans in place are fully funded to make sure that programs are running, food is coming in, and the most vulnerable are receiving food.
Throughout the implementation of the grain deal, Russia has basically, you know, pulled out of it briefly in November, then rejoined it. What needs to happen?
My focus is really on the humanitarian impact of the deal falling to pieces. The deal has been successful, even with some of the wobbles that have been experienced over the last year plus. More than 30 million tons of food has made its way through the system. And even though less than a million of those tons have made it to war-torn countries in Africa, the general impact it's had on the market has been stabilizing. So we're very, very worried that it's fallen apart. And as I said, the world community needs to continue to apply pressure to these negotiations, seeing how they can incentivize Russia back to the table through carrot or stick. But otherwise, they need to focus on preventing famine around the world.
Why is the world so reliant on Russia? You know, because they are also big exporters of wheat with Ukraine. So which other country, in your view, could fill in that gap?
So the situation as we've seen it over the last year is that, yes, 80% of East Africa's grain that is imported comes from Ukraine and Russia previously to this war. What has happened is that countries around the world have found other suppliers, but it's placed greater pressure, more demand on the supply chain, therefore driving up the prices. So we've seen in the most vulnerable countries in Somalia and Kenya, Ethiopia, we've seen price increases of up to 40%. Normal everyday families have had to find that much money to be able to afford to keep their kids with food and alive. So if this deal does fall apart, as it seems to have done today, we fear that the price of food will even go much higher. So we're very, very, very worried.
How are organizations like yours able to help these people, you know, if this is becoming the emergency that everybody is expecting, what will be needed from the NGOs, and will you be able to put boots on the ground in those countries?
The International Rescue Committee is just about 90 years old now. We're in 40 countries, including all of the countries that are affected as a result of this deal falling apart. Our role on the ground, working with other humanitarian organizations, is, as you say, to provide grain. Our specific niche is putting money into people's pockets, distributing cash so they can afford the increases in the price of food, so they can continue feeding their families. We also work in hospitals and clinics across all of these affected countries, dealing with the most severe impacts of this deal falling apart, which is mother and child malnutrition, saving small children's lives, helping stabilize them and get them back onto the road to recovery when they've been without food for many weeks at a time. So we're working in many different ways. And to be honest, we're now bracing for impact with this deal falling apart. Our clinics and hospitals are going to be overrun very soon as a result.
Bob Kitchen with the International Rescue Committee speaking with VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias. Asia, Europe, and the United States baked under extreme heat on Monday as global temperatures soared toward alarming highs, while U.S. leaders sought to reignite climate diplomacy with China. The United States suffered record-setting heat in the West and South, flood triggering rain in the Northeast, and choking wildfire smoke from Canada in the Midwest. National Weather Service meteorologist Josh Weiss speaking to the Associated Press.
There are approximately 34 million people under an excessive heat warning, and an additional 9 million people under heat advisories. And a lot of that is basically from California through Mississippi, that southern tier of the United States. It's possible those numbers will increase as we go through the week as the heat expands eastward a little bit.
Italian health authorities are issuing heat warnings as southern Europe enters a brutally hot week, and Greece orders wildfire evacuations. More from Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma.
The health ministry has issued 10 recommendations to protect elderly people, the sick, and pets from the heat. Officials are urging people to stay indoors during the hottest hours, drink at least half a gallon of water a day, and refrain from strenuous exercise at peak daylight times. The mercury in Rome is reaching 102 degrees Fahrenheit this afternoon. Italy's capital is expected to be even hotter on Tuesday. Meanwhile, authorities in Greece have issued precautionary evacuation orders at several seaside areas south of Athens as a mountain wildfire moves toward the sea, while a second large wildfire also broke out in a wooded area west of Athens. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The year 2023 has so far not been such a good one for Africa. Conflict has erupted in Sudan, deepened in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and spread southward from the Sahel. Extreme weather, often attributed to climate change, has triggered devastating droughts and floods in places like Kenya and South Sudan, deepening poverty. And as Lisa Bryant reports, many African countries are now struggling under massive debt.
Africa is facing a tough year, from conflict in Sudan and the Sahel to droughts, floods, and other extreme weather events. But in a recent interview with VOA, the head of the African Development Bank, Akinwumi Adesina, is focusing on the continent's promise and how to better harness its rich environmental and human capital. Lisa Bryant has more for VOA from Paris. African Development Bank President Akinwumi Adesina is looking at Africa's bottom line, but not the one used by number crunchers that looks at the value of a country's goods and services.
The way in which we measure wealth may in fact have driven many of these nature-rich countries into a higher level of debt and poverty traps.
Instead, he's pushing for another accounting method, looking at the massive natural wealth of African countries like those in the forest-rich Congo Basin, which helps absorb climate emissions, among other positive nature-based solutions.
Gabon, DRC, Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Angola. If you look at all of these countries that are in the Congo Basin area in particular, rich biodiversity, carbon sink, the largest carbon sink in the world. They get nothing for that. I've been pushing now that we need to revalue the wealth of the countries based on their natural capital.
A Adesina spoke with VOA after a recent Paris summit intended to raise and rethink financing so poorer nations can tackle development and climate change. While activists say more must be done, observers say it delivered some concrete results, including a deal to restructure Zambia's $6.3 billion debt, $4 billion of which is owed to China.
I think that is good progress. It's slow, painful progress. I think we should be much faster. Creditors, time doesn't matter really so much for them, but the debtor countries can't. They need solutions now.
The West accuses China especially of pushing African countries into so-called debt traps for political or economic gain, something Beijing denies. Adesina didn't comment on that, but said China, which holds 14% of Africa's debt, must be part of other future debt solutions.
They are open to participating in collectively solving this problem for other countries. I would expect that they will have to do that anyway, given the amount of exposure that those countries have to them.
Rich nations in Paris also agreed to move $100 billion held by the International Monetary Fund into a climate and poverty fund for low-income countries. Adesina and others have been pushing for the money, part of so-called special drawing rights or SDRs, to be channeled through the African Development Bank and similar multilateral development banks.
Every dollar of SDR that comes to us becomes it's leveraged 3 to 4 times. So the leverage factor is very, very important. And the SDR donors lose nothing. And it comes at zero cost because we actually pay an interest rate for it.
Adesina also says natural resource-backed loans that tap Africa's rich trove of oil, gas, and minerals should be off the table completely. He calls them toxic, non-transparent debts that mortgage the future of African nations. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
We're following these other stories from around the world. U.S. President Joe Biden on Monday invited Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to Washington for an official visit at a date to be determined. The ongoing war between Sudan's military and a paramilitary force has driven already struggling residents into deeper depths of hunger and poverty, according to a new Reuters report. The United States is concerned about developments in Thailand's legal system after two separate complaints against the leader of the party that won the most seats in a May 14th election. Thailand's parliament is preparing for a second vote on Wednesday. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
For years, scientists have estimated that the universe is approximately 13.8 billion years old. Now, a scientist in Canada is proposing, in a new study, that the universe could be 26.7 billion years old, about 13 billion years older than what is currently thought. If the universe is about 13.8 billion years old, scientists have wondered what explains the existence of the 14.4 billion-year-old Methuselah star. Astronomers are also considering Webb telescope discoveries of highly evolved galaxies that existed only several hundred million years after the Big Bang. Scientists say these early galaxies seem to be at a level of maturity and mass that is usually linked with stars that have gone through billions of years of cosmic evolution. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. The U.S. Senate will begin debate this week on a massive spending bill, setting the spending priorities for the U.S. military for the coming year. Democrats and Republicans have already clashed in the House of Representatives over how much the legislation should include for aid to Ukraine, diversity initiatives, and abortion. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has details in this report.
The Republican-led U.S. House of Representatives passed the $874.2 billion defense legislation on Friday by a vote of 219 to 210, authorizing new funding to modernize the U.S. military.
Cutting-edge technology that is essential for the future of this country and to keep freedom around the world in the rise of China and Russia will receive more investment than we've watched in the past.
Five Republican-led attempts to end U.S. aid to Ukraine failed. The majority of Republicans voted with Democrats to pass $300 million in funding for Ukraine. But conservatives did score several victories against the Biden administration.
Taxpayer money is provided to the DOD and intended to provide for our national defense and our national security. It is not to promote and support the Biden administration's radical, immoral, pro-abortion agenda.
Republicans argue that government health insurance should not cover abortions for service members and that the Pentagon should not lead diversity initiatives that include outreach to transgender people.
It is woefully irresponsible that extreme MAGA Republicans have hijacked a bipartisan bill that is essential to our national security and taken it over and weaponized it in order to jam their extreme right-wing ideology down the throats of the American people.
Those conservative priorities in the House bill mean it has no chance of passage in the Democratic-controlled U.S. Senate.
Obviously, a lot of these amendments will be probably stripped out, and the Senate will have a little different version. But overall, you know, an increase in defense spending and our troops get a pay raise. It's a very critical time right now. It's a dangerous world.
The Senate will begin debate Tuesday, with its final legislation expected to look very different from the House-passed version. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
In Afghanistan, the Taliban have ordered women's beauty salons to close in a month. Beauty salon owners and women's rights activists called the decision devastating. For VOA, Farkunda Pamani has the story.
Women's activists and watchdogs say that the Taliban's new ban on their businesses will push them further into poverty and isolation. The recent decree mandates that beauty salons shut down in a month, adding to the string of restrictions faced by Afghan women. The Taliban also prohibit women from accessing secondary education, employment, and public spaces. Kabul salon owner Banu Amiri, who did not want to use her real name, fears her family's livelihood will suffer if the ban is implemented.
If I lose my source of income from the beauty salon, I will not be able to pay for my children's education, and my children will remain uneducated. When I cannot work, I will not be able to pay the rent of the house.
There are more than 12,000 women's beauty salons in Afghanistan, and more than 3,000 of them are in Kabul, according to the Afghanistan's Chamber of Commerce and Investment. The ban calls into question the Taliban's promise to allow women to participate in the private sector.
The only way for women to earn money was working in the private sector. With the closing of beauty salons, many women who were the breadwinners of their families lose their job and income, and their lives will become harder and darker.
Heather Barr, Associate Director of Women's Rights Division at Human Rights Watch, worries the ban will result in a significant loss for women in Afghanistan.
This is not about whether you can go and get your hair and nails done. Beauty salons are a women-only space that can offer community and support to women in a situation where they've already lost many other sources of support, including the entire system to deal with domestic violence. So this is actually a devastating loss for women. In general,
Banu Amiri and other women like her want the Taliban to reconsider their decision.
Our demand is that they regulate beauty salons but not close them completely. They should not take away our livelihood from us.
The UN has called on the Taliban to withdraw the ban, which it says will impact negatively on the economy and contradicts stated support for women entrepreneurship. Farhunda Paimani, VOA News, Washington.
And finally today, in the predominantly Roman Catholic Philippines, a debate is raging over whether to teach teenagers about contraceptives. Comprehensive sex education is required in public schools, but not all schools are following through. Dave Grunbaum has the story.
Yung family planning, yung mga pills, condom, IUD, injectable implant.
A workshop for a group of teens on a day off from school.
In some countries, classroom discussions about sex and contraceptives are common for teenagers, but not in the Philippines. Jo Marie Oliva is a community mobilizer for Lekaan, a non-government organization that focuses on reproductive health, access to contraceptives, and sex education. They do not always teach kids sex education. You do not always learn all the ways to protect yourself from unplanned pregnancies, how to use condoms, and other contraceptives. Advocates for comprehensive sex education say the lack of lessons as well as laws requiring parental consent for minors to access contraceptives are why government data shows 1 out of 10 births in the country is by a mother younger than 19. There are teens who do not know that a woman can get pregnant the first time she has sex. 17-year-old Hannah Alahas says she did not understand how birth control pills work until she took this workshop. I've heard about pills before, but I only really learned about them now. Conservative voices in the country, including the influential Catholic Church, oppose the use of contraceptives as well as lessons about them. Father Jerome Cecilano is with the Catholic Bishops' Conference of the Philippines.
We start by telling them that the sex should be done not outside the marriage but inside the marriage. And secondly, do not use contraceptives. And thirdly, that you need to preserve your body. You are still young and sexual intercourse is not yet part of your, I don't know, biological age, and you have to do it when you're already married.
Erickson Bernardo of the Lekaan Center for Women's Health has a different take.
I believe discussion of all forms of contraception, both modern artificial and natural family planning, is very important. So you don't actually encourage them to have sex, but basically you allow them to make responsible decisions.
In 2012, a law was passed expanding sex education in public schools, but more than a decade later, its implementation across the country is spotty.
There are some school administrators who are willing to adapt comprehensive sexuality education so long as not in their schools.
Lekaan says while the pace is slow, gradually more schools are teaching students about all methods of birth control. Meantime, outreach workers such as Oliva try to fill the gap. Dave Grunebaum for VOA News, Malabon, Philippines.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have yourself a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From the earliest days of the Russian invasion of its neighbor, Russia unleashed a campaign of gross and systematic violations against Ukraine's civilian population. An avalanche of evidence supports thousands of reports of crimes against humanity and war crimes, ranging from attacks on civilian infrastructure, including schools and hospitals, to appalling violence against civilians and outright murder of Ukrainian noncombatants. When it comes to justice and accountability for these crimes, there are 5 pathways to justice, said United States Ambassador at Large for Global Criminal Justice Beth Van Schaak at a special briefing. First, there is the International Criminal Court.
We've seen the prosecutor make his first move, successfully achieving 2 arrest warrants for very senior figures within Russia, focused on the deportation of children from Ukraine and temporarily controlled or occupied areas into Russia, often to very far-flung places, and subjecting those children to adoption or other situations, notwithstanding that they have loved ones, guardians, families who want them back.
Second are cases within the Ukrainian national courts, said Ambassador Van Schaak.
The Atrocity Crimes Advisory Group, which is a joint initiative of the United States, the United Kingdom, and the European Union, is fully operational on the ground. We have deployed a number of experts to work side by side with their Ukrainian counterparts to help sift through the now tens of thousands of recorded potential war crimes and other atrocities.
Third, European countries are opening investigations for those cases when individual perpetrators may end up within their borders or within their jurisdictional reach. Fourth, an international center that will support nations already building cases against senior Russian leaders for the crime of aggression resulting from the country's invasion of Ukraine, opened in The Hague on July 3rd. And finally, the United States Attorney General has stood up a war crimes accountability team. WARCAT, it's called, said Ambassador Van Schaak.
We have a dedicated war crimes accountability team that is looking at cases that might have some kind of a U.S. nexus and be able to proceed here in U.S. courts under the new legal authorities that Congress has provided.
If Russia had not chosen to invade its sovereign neighbor, we would not see the terrible war crimes happening on the ground, said Ambassador Venskok. And so it's quite important for Ukraine to see this crime prosecuted.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.